Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We've been watching our HD world of 2018 in a dazzling sports mirror all week. A kaleidoscope of bodies. A social culture in struggle. Fresh captions this hour. Through the smoke of a war of succession, Serena to Naomi in women's tennis.
You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter and I stand what's right for her and I've never cheated. And you owe me an apology. You will never do that again. This is not fair. There's a lot of men out here that have said a lot of things and because they're men.
Osaka, 6-2, 6-4.
Naomi Osaka, U.S. Open champion, but in the most controversial U.S. Open final ever. Booze for Carlos Ramos as he exits.
And then the bounding cast of Colin Kaepernick's Nike ad. An idea in every frame of it, touching race, gender, aspiration, resistance, just do it, dreams, competitive struggle, and global commerce in sneakers as well.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
Claudia Rankine gets us started. She's the poet who launched microaggressions into conversations beyond counting 3 years ago. She's the woman who has refined the science, the poetics of close reading our impressions of black bodies, and especially the struggles of Serena Williams on the tennis court. When Claudia Rankine said she would review Serena's weekend for us, we asked her to start with a bit of the prose chapter on Serena from her best-selling book titled Citizen in 2015.
Insane is what you think one Sunday afternoon during an Arnold Palmer watching the 2009 Women's U.S. Open semifinal when brought to full attention by the suddenly explosive behavior of Serena Williams. Serena in HD before your eyes becomes overcome by a rage you recognize and have been taught to hold at a distance for your own good. Serena's behavior on this particular Sunday afternoon suggests that all the injustice she has played through all the years of her illustrious career flashes before her, and she decides finally to respond to all of it with a string of invectives. Nothing, not even the repetition of negations. No, no, no. She employs in a similar situation years before as a younger player at the 2004 U.S. Open prepares you for this. Oh my God, she's gone crazy, you say to no one.
And then Claudia Rankine jumped straight to color commentary from the heart.
But you know what I want to add to that?
Please.
For this U.S. Open, it was actually the opposite. She did not go crazy. She said, I want an apology from you. She said, you stole a point from me. You're a thief. That, to me, was a composed Serena Williams. I mean, upset, yes. Overwhelmed, yes. Emotional, yes. But not 2009. That's why this is ironic in some senses.
Mm.
Because when you think about what she said, I need an apology from you. You stole something from me. You're a thief. That's nothing. And that's why people are settling in on this notion of sexism. Because when you listen to the things that have come out of the mouth of Andy Murray, of Novak Djokovic, and then somebody turns around and says, I need an apology from you, and you say that's verbal abuse? I don't think so.
You've trained us, Claudia, to see, and it has been seen before, that Serena's moments of huge triumph and losing it can all come moments apart. And it's happened before, and it did this weekend. I mean, the depths of struggle and lost matches are just moments away from incredible peaks of performance and victory. Was the balance any different this past weekend?
No, I think one of the things that was sad about the umpire inserting himself into the match. We know that Serena gets fueled by her emotions late in matches and has turned them around. We've seen it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly influenced the match, which is not to say she would have won. Who knows, you know? But we have seen her come back in exactly these moments, in exactly this emotional state. And also, where, for me, racial politics plays in the weekend was that we all know that for Black people, any accusation of cheating attaches to Blackness and refuses to separate. And so when Serena said, "I'm not a cheater," she knows that if people walk away from this match thinking that she cheated, it will affirm something they already think about Black people in general. And they will not let it go. So I believe that that really unsettled her. Maria Sharapova can take illegal drugs and come back and nobody mentions it again. Had that been Serena, we would hear about it and hear about it and hear about it repeatedly. She knows that. She knows that the white imagination has already attached criminality to Blackness and that they're just waiting for a moment to confirm it.
Claudia, you've also taught us that, you know, she changed the game of tennis, a game reserved for reserved people once upon a time, because she gives it her whole, the whole human spectrum, humor and rage and triumph and anger.
Three people came out of that match looking incredible to me. One of them was Serena. One of them was Naomi Osaka. And the other one was the crowd. Because for the first time, we had a stadium of fans who were able to read the situation and see Serena as a human being in need of their support.
Interesting.
And they gave it. And it allowed her then to show up for Naomi in an incredible moment in her athletic career. You know, when Serena said, "Okay, let's honor Naomi," she won the match. And the crowd stopped booing at that moment, and things moved forward. So I think we have come far. You know, people were able to see the limits of the umpire, whether or not by the letter of the law, he's right. We could see his limits as a human being, which is not to say that Serena wasn't overwhelmed and emotional. She was.
I think you've got to take some of the credit for the evolution in our feelings, our tolerance, our understanding of what's going on inside that woman as well as on that court.
People show up when they understand the full humanity of other people. It was just very heartening for me to see those stands able to say, you know, something is not right here.
What was the toughest moment for you just watching Serena?
When she seemed confused about what was happening was also when I was confused about what was happening. And so in that moment, there was that sense of, not again. What is happening? You know, is she okay? What's going to happen now? You can see her sort of like, what? So then the U.S. Open becomes a kind of trigger for that moment of injustice, whether you want to call it sexism or whatever. So it's no longer about the actual moment, but the whole history. In epigenetics, they have discovered the fact that in African-American women, there is a gene that is almost like a stress gene, and it's been in African Americans for 400 years, and it's passed down through the mother. And it accounts for many of the problems around childbirth, like higher mortality rates or lower birth weight. And I was thinking also about the trouble Serena had when she gave birth, and we always think about Serena is somebody who could bear it, who can bear it all and come out on the other side. I mean, obviously, she's won so many Grand Slams. She can pull things out. But then I was thinking about the stress on her body. It's a real thing. And it has shown itself in the birth of her child. And now she's passed it down to her daughter. They found the gene in Jews after the Holocaust. And it's basically environmental stress rather than biological stress, you know?
Right.
But then it imprints and is passed on. And so when we see Serena on the court, we're not just seeing a person. We're seeing the history of a certain kind of racial stress, trying to live beyond that. And it's a fight, and we see it in her, in the ways in which she gets overwhelmed.
One last question for old-timers like me who remember Jackie Robinson stealing home at Braves Field in Boston in the early 1950s. Serena carries a fight against sexism as well as racism, but remind me of the fundamental differences here, if there are any. The virtuosity, the mental toughness, the incredible combativeness, the complete awareness of an historic burden, all of these things.
Well, I don't think we have to say that there's a difference. I think all of these athletes, these black athletes, they know the arena in which they are performing. I mean, you have the Colin Kaepernicks who, you know, make the decision to say, the state of the union is bigger than my career as an athlete. You know, and that's why it's sort of shocking when they don't, when you have the Tiger Woods, you know, people who don't see how they're positioned, how they're riding on the shoulders of the Jackie Robinsons and the Serena Williams of the world.
That was the poet Claudia Rankin of the bestseller Citizen, an American Lyric from 2015. She's the playwright, too, of The White Card. Coming up, a shadow of Afro-pessimism, as it's called, lurking around what also feels like a cultural boom time in Black America. This is Open Source. Ed Pavlich is our guest, poet and novelist at the University of Georgia, inspired reader of African-American literature, and a great student of Black music, too, old and new music. There's history unfolding in front of us, Ed, and we're still mindful of living on at the 50th anniversary of 1968, coming up on a milestone, the Mexico City Olympics, where the winning American runners Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their black fists in a civil rights protest on the reviewing stand. Would you just give us your 50-year highlight reel of where we've been in sports and race?
Oh, wow.
And maybe the direction of things after the tennis open?
Well, sure. Yes, I mean, 50 years from 1968, the Summer Olympics in Mexico City, when, of course, that iconic moment after the 200-meter final occurred with John Carlos and Tommy Smith and Peter Norman of Australia, who had won the silver medal in the race, there on the podium during the American National Anthem with the black power salute, you know, with the black fists raised, the head bowed, feet out of their shoes, and, you know, standing there for all the world to see, quite a moment. It's still alive in our culture. It's still very much, maybe more than ever, on our minds. There was a time when that image was quite rare. I remember when I was a teenager being kind of, you know, in pursuit of that image. I had seen it, then it would go away. You know, Ebony magazine would fly through and look for it again, then it would appear again. And finally, I found myself researching where it had come from. Many people don't know that Peter Norman was also expelled from the Olympic Village after that incident for wearing the button. If you look closely at that picture, you'll see he's wearing a button on his warm-up, and it was a pro-Olympic protest button. And he, you know, suffered along with those men in some ways, not nearly to the extent they did, of course.
You followed it so, closely, you know, Ed. I mean, highlights, lowlights, the direction of things 50 years later.
You know, we can't trace it through the timeline, but certainly black athletes' image in the culture has been politicized. This has been something that certain athletes have embraced and others had tried to elude. Sometimes it's real political protest, like the Olympic protests. In other cases, it's just simply importing of a certain kind of style in American culture into the courts or fields or arenas that's new to the game. For example, I remember the style of the early 90s UNLV basketball team, Larry Johnson, Stacey Augman, Anderson Hunt, Greg Anthony, just being like a beautiful band of brotherhood on the court, highly stylized, very confrontational with the opponent, but at the same time very loving with each other. And this was something that I had seen on basketball courts my whole life growing up and loved and wanted to be a part of. I had never seen it in sanctioned play under the auspices of American universities, which were busy at the culmination of the 1980s, breaking people down into individuals and setting them into competition with each other. That thing morphed into the what they call the Fab Five, you know, the Michigan starting five, all freshmen, all black, with a kind of swagger, even more than the UNLV squad in the early 90s, changed so much about the body language of basketball. I remember relying on those images for a counter to this rampant individualism in the academic culture and the mainstream culture of the 80s and early 90s, you know, the Reagan and Bush era, as it were. So those teams really propelled so much into our contemporary moment. The Ice Cubes of the world, the rappers of the world were in, very immediate conversations with those styles, and one thing led to another, and
we've also seen, you're reminding me, Ed, this marvelous asymmetry between or matching differences between the NBA and the NFL. Mm-hmm. The NBA of LeBron James, defiant toward Donald Trump, and Trump's own NFL, dare I say his own Tom Brady, and a completely different politics and style, a lot of the same fan bases, but make of it what we must.
Well, I don't know if the NBA and the NFL have such similar fan bases or not, but clearly the leagues have a very different style in today's politics. Led by LeBron James in some ways, but also welcomed in ways by the NBA administration, you know, by the commissioner and the people that work with him, in ways that the NFL has tried to really clamp down on, you know, certainly in my witnessing of this, with the owners to try to really sanction players' behavior and speech in ways that the NBA has tried to avoid doing, for sure. The reality is that in NBA culture, the players are so much more exposed. The fans are so much closer to their faces, to their bodies. And their communities, therefore, are really in a far more proximate place in the culture of that game. I think the connection between the players and the communities in basketball is something irrepressible. You couldn't have the game without it. I think the league knows it, and I think that's part of why these sports are operating so differently right now as we watch.
I want to come back to expressionism in sports, including, pointing to the Almighty on good times, spiking the ball, all that sort of thing. And I want to come back also to your reading of Serena. You're a close reader there, but I want to introduce Syreeta McFadden. She writes a column on America for The Guardian in England, also Elle, the fashion magazine. She writes about gender, politics, race, and culture, and she's a professor of English at the City University of New York. Syreeta, welcome. You're used to sort of summing up our scene for people far away. What do you make of this net montage, I'm calling it, from last weekend?
This orchestra of sports, culture, and politics all exploding in our face.
In HD, it's, yes.
In HD. It's a really remarkable moment. You know, I think all it does is reveal just kind of, well, it just reveals where we're at as a culture, in a sense of actually creating space for the full humanity of Serena Williams, mm-hmm. and really, and also really acknowledging her, you know, she became kind of like a flashpoint for not for women across the board, but definitely for Black women, but where we all kind of really were so present and living with her in that moment at the US Open this past weekend, but also just this kind of, you know, there's a pugnacious and assertive kind of movement that's happening within sports by this marriage between Nike and Kaepernick. I mean, granted, there's a commerce conversation to be had about that and what that might mean, but for Nike to actually stake their brand with Kaepernick, Colin Kaepernick's face, much to the ire of a whole host of folks within the American Project, it's fascinating. It's actually a kind of an exciting time.
So how did you sort, you as a African American woman, mm-hmm. sort out the pairing in Serena's case of addressing sexism and racism?
Well, they feel in it, they're inseparable to me. You know, what Serena is the foremost, one of the greatest athletes of all time, the greatest tennis player of all time. We did, like, that's indisputable. But she is a woman and she is Black. And in that space, I don't, and tennis being a kind of like being a pretty white sport, even in 2018, a pretty white dominated sport, even like safely into the 21st century, you still have these norms that are kind of assigned to the sport itself in terms of how women are to engage with conflict, or even just the concept of how their bodies and their voices are even to address issues on the court. And so for Serena to assert herself and defend her sportsmanship, to defend her professionalism, but for everyone to see a Black body also do that work as well, was significant. But not even making any apologies or demurring to the idea of what people imagine or at least the limits, as Ms. Rankin has said, of Ramos's imagination or white imagination about Black women in positions of authority and power, for her to stake her claim and to insist upon the respect that she has felt like more than earned, was significant, and relatable.
How did you read the crowd back and forth?
The crowd was in her corner, and the crowd finally had an opportunity to witness some of the things that we've been describing, like maybe they've heard in conversation or maybe they've like been skeptical about in terms of the dynamic between folks in authority and folks, you know, and folk in and being in a position of your workplace. So in that moment, the crowd witnessed what they thought was, you know, an unfair action, you know, brought like, you know, I'm with the crowd in some respects, in a sense of believing that Ramos's actions inserting himself into the play into the game was, you know, it kind of tipped it, because you know that's the thing that rattles Serena Williams. You know, that's it, like she can pull herself back together, you know, have the explosion of like emotion or rage and still put that power back behind the racket in the court and at play. But that was, you know, the crowd was absolutely like finally got a chance to witness in sharp relief what we might mean when we say microaggression. She didn't, like, Serena was respectful, like, you know, like her voice shake, emotional, but like she was still, she did not like use the kind of like behavior and language we have seen the other male players do.
I get it, Sarita. Hang on. I want to, our historian, Ed Pavlich, there's a history of Nike ads too, Ed. Review them, 30 years. And one of them might have saved Nike from Reebok, taking out from the Beatles line. You say you want a revolution.
Well, I mean, Nike has certainly been a happy partner to many, many lucrative arrangements with high-profile athletes, no question about it. Most noteworthy above and beyond everybody's reckoning is, of course, Michael Jordan, you know,
yes.
who was famously very, very, very politically silent and neutral, but who was, you know, made a mark in sports marketing that set up a whole new paradigm. I think I read a couple years ago that the Air Jordan brand sells 2/3 of the basketball sneakers on earth.
Wow.
Not just Nike, but just his brand in Nike. So it's just, it's a massive, massive thing. But what I want to say about Nike and advertising is really about the new ad that was running during the U.S. Open with Serena and her father.
You got to be quick, Ed. Go ahead.
Okay, I just think that that Nike ad with Serena and her father is one of the great, great, great advertising spots I've ever seen. And I encourage everyone to seek it out on YouTube and watch it.
Nike, the ad agency. Hold it there. There is another lens that people are bringing to this whole spectacle. The perspective is called Afro-pessimism, a mix of critical theory and street corner intuition. And we got an introduction this week from the most cited source on the subject, Professor Frank Wilderson at the University of California, Irvine. The fundamental idea is that a primal, universal, deeper than deep, anti-blackness is embedded in all of us, including black people. There are many other real disadvantages out there, poverty, exploitation, human hatreds that Frank Wilderson would call important. But in our collective brain, the universal fear of blackness is underlined as essential.
If at the end of the day one is so oppressed in one's color, in one's gender, in one's economic status, that one feels that one is about to fall off the face of the earth, that they're so downtrodden that the end is in sight, then one can always say, aha, in a kind of recovery, aha, at least I am not black. At least I'm not black. We'd argue that blackness as slaveness serves a important stabilizing function in the collective psyche of the world. That in other words, even though the chains came off and the South supposedly lost the war in 1865, what remained intact was a sensibility, kind of language of the mind that understands that to be is to not be black. What Afro-pessimism is, it's not a sadness, it's not an emotional characteristic or dispensation. It is pessimism towards the theory of emancipation that all sorts of other oppressed groups have, as though that theory of emancipation can apply to blackness. I think that Kaepernick and Serena are raising awareness about the problem. I do not think that the awareness that they're raising is going to contribute to the capacity for other people to see blacks as human. That just can't happen.
How does an Afro-pessimist read, for example, the tennis score, but all the other events and feeling around it, including the everywhere Nike ad by Colin Kaepernick selling sneakers and distressing stockholders, apparently? Read that montage of images and arguments we've been hearing in the past week. Your way.
I think Nike is kind of smart in a way that, you know, I'm not celebrating it, but as capitalists, they understand that buzz in the long run means money. Even in the short run, if it means, you know, a falling stock share or bad press, there's no such thing as bad press. Buzz means money.
Right.
You know, and this is the point. People are saying Nike's making this political gesture towards black rage and alienating its white customers. Nike is thinking long term. This buzz is going to rejuvenate it in the long run. But what I'm trying to say is that it is not a subversive political move on Nike's part. It is a shrewd business calculation.
Frank, you say anti-blackness is in the collective unconscious and deeper than our politics, deeper than family, deeper than almost anything. Does it encompass black people too? I mean, we all know
yes.
that black people notice immediately gradations of color among so-called black people. Do they learn to battle it? And if they can learn to battle it, why can't I? Why can't other white people?
I'm sorry to disappoint, maybe disappoint you, I don't know. But these things can change, but they're not going to change peacefully. And they're not going to change in any short time. It took oceans of violence to bring about this world. Any civilized, so-called civilized country is birthed on blood, oceans of violence. And it does not negotiate itself out of existence. Only violent revolutions change things in essential ways. If you're interested in changing things in important ways, you don't need a violent revolution. But anti-blackness is essential to human existence. And those things that are essential do not get negotiated out of existence.
Wilderson in Southern California this week. His book, Red, Black, and White, is one place to start. He's got a new book going to press on Afro-pessimism. Coming up, the eminence across the board in African-American letters, Daryl Pinkney. Reviewing Ta-Nehisi Coates, Daryl Pinkney writes about the temptation of Afro-pessimism. This is Open Source. Daryl Pinkney joins us from New York, prolific essayist and critic. His last book is a novel, Black Deutschland. In the New York Review of Books this summer, Daryl Pinkney, you introduced us to Frank Wilderson at the center of Afro-pessimism, but with a caution. Give us your reservation and welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I don't think I feel that anti-black is essentialism or innate in people. I'm afraid it describes the usefulness of a power relation that we haven't been able to free ourselves from.
Hmm.
New World slavery was around for so many centuries. The racism that grew from it and supported it can't be expected to go away overnight. But the people we're talking about this week are not products of Afro-pessimism.
Hmm.
The Williams sisters had a sort of deep realist for a father, but also someone who, in one way or another, taught them to dream big time.
Hmm.
So I'm not so sure I agree. I just think that in this time of the liberal consensus falling apart, people are feeling rather vulnerable and not certain where to turn. Things are unclear in the fog. But Afro-pessimism, I don't think, is it.
Your warning, Daryl Pinkney, came in a review of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book on Obama time, which was
right.
titled We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy.
Right.
Where in the play of common conversation do you hear, and how would you define that Afro-pessimism in a popular sense? Where is it in our culture today?
Well, I think that certainly in Black America, there's always been a sort of dual approach to things, and this kind of fatalistic nothing will ever change, white people will never change, the system is unfair, racism is systemic. All of which is maybe true or not true, but there's this deep sort of feeling that on top of it all, you will not make me such a fool as to hope or believe in these American possibilities. Now, I think that's always been a sort of parallel strain in the freedom struggle itself.
Your review... almost casually introduced the alternative. I don't know if we call it Afro-optimism, but in that New York Review piece, you wrote, 25 years ago, black people were the lost population in this country, abandoned
right.
in inner
right.
cities, overrun with drugs, exhorted by politicians and preachers to mend the broken black family. Black intellectuals were on the defensive. Today, you say, white people are the ones who seem lost, who don't seem to know who they are. What is that?
Well, I don't know that much about tennis, so forgive me. So one of the things that's the image that haunts me the most from what I've seen of the match is that we're watching a great champion match between two women of color.
Yes. Yes.
And I sort of am more struck by that than by anything. And it is the sort of white referees and the umpires who look out of place, try to stay in control of a game that has in some ways moved beyond them. We're also watching a real human drama, this great champion in defeat. It has happened. Just as, athletics, sports, this isn't the arts. It's the great sort of spectacle for modern societies. And so how images read or play is in some ways very different and very visceral. It's interesting to watch this match or what you can of it with the sound off.
Yeah. I'm so glad you made that point. I've been thinking of Japan and Haiti celebrating this victory. Not to mention the globalism in that Nike worldwide
right.
base. I mean,
yeah.
anything but the nationalist, xenophobic, protectionist
right.
trend that we're told to worry about. I want to get
is...
here. Forgive me. Right. I want to hear Sarita McFadden and then Ed Pavlich on this point. Sarita, the big trend here. Well, in what Daryl is saying, I mean, we may have missed the point, all of it.
Maybe we missed a point in the earlier point of our conversation, but I don't think the optics were lost on anybody that you were watching two women of color, two black women, in what was historically a very white sport, battle it out for one of the top titles in the sport. And what has been curious is that the American media, in response to it, has tried to erase Naomi Osaka's ethnic background to the extent that they would drop the Haitian part of her heritage and just refer to her Japanese nationality. And we see that even further in this horrendous caricature of Serena that was in a Melbourne newspaper, I think it was the Herald Sun, where the cartoonist draws an exaggerated Serena body that harkens back to some Jim Crow toxic racist categorization of a black woman's body and misrepresent Naomi Osaka's body as a blonde and very much a lighter skinned version of what she is.
That's one desperate cartoonist in Australia, though. Ed Pavlich, where are you on the optimism, pessimism reading of this history before our eyes?
Well, I think it's interesting to come at this, to view that match, to listen to the conversations, to read the pieces while living in the Deep South. I have to say, the choice between despair over the lack of prospects for participation in the American mainstream, or a kind of optimism, delusional or not, for about the prospects of full inclusion in that story, are one thing. But what I see and feel around me in the Deep South is a kind of a third thing, which is to say that black people have also created their own realities and standards, a kind of love between each other, a way of seeing, we talk about optics, a way of seeing oneself in the mirror and each other on the street, which isn't finally mediated by CBS or ESPN or Fox or Donald Trump or even Barack Obama for that matter, although he helped. I see in the Williams phenomenon in tennis this beloved story of a family who has kind of broken down the gates of a formerly all-white country club sport, not just white, but country club sport. As you said, Chris, a sport formerly reserved for the reserved.
I think and I stole that from you, Ed. Go ahead.
Yes, you did. That's cool, though. and remade that sport into an expressive medium capable of utterance over a wide, wide range of energies and emotions that, you know, one could never have imagined tennis to carry before. It's just pessimism, optimism, I don't know, but that is an incredible achievement that I do think bear artistic and aesthetic qualities on par with, you know, anything the Baldwins and Ellisons did in their own mediums.
Daryl Pinkney, I want to put it back to you about the sense, my sense, that there's a sort of border crossing underway. It's generational. It's a matter of feeling, and aesthetic too. But speak of the generations here. I mean,
well, I think that the gender aspect, how important that is partly driven by generational change. I mean, hashtag Me Too is also an expression of generational change. Of you know, the social climate changing, it's like sort of smoking being out overnight. That kind of enabling male predatory culture is out overnight. I think there's that. I think that also the people we're talking about belong to a new generation, already in some ways a passing generation in sports. Black sports figures have always represented these things and had to deal with this kind of gaze, so to speak, just because, you know, being a sports hero does mean so much to the country that people are very nervous about the politicized meanings that just having the black body there can mean. I completely agree with the gentleman about the shrewdness of Nike. Nevertheless, it fascinates me that they're gambling on the mainstream or the feeling, going with Kaepernick and the ad. It's a much different gesture from the one made in Mexico City in 1968, including even the kneeling. And the ad is all about sort of striving, and you are no one's victim. You know, sort of set your own boundaries or not. And so, you know, I'm very touched by these messages, you know, at a time when the world is in sort of really deep peril. So, you know, in some ways, these are sort of like the last parties before the storm.
Maybe. You're reminding me of Anthony Appiah's book on things that do change, and they change overnight, like dueling. It went out in a week, the binding of feet in China. And his point was that suddenly, sometime, they seem ridiculous. This is absurd. Smoking is self-destruction, and things do happen. Or is that too optimistic? Sarita, what do you think about the change underway?
Well, I mean, I love the points that both gentlemen have brought up, because, you know, our sports figures are change agents. And if anything, what our American moment of crisis is allows for an opportunity for us to really face up to some serious questions about what we value and what kind of world we imagine we can march forward to as we power through the 21st century. And I love the fact that, you know, while I empathize with pessimism, it's more like watching or witnessing Black people or Blackness really succeed at creating something marvelous, just in sport and in art and in literature. So, you know, it's like what we I'm trying to remain optimistic, because I think we know another world is possible. And as long as we're actively engaged in this conversation and looking at you know, the drama that our sports heroes show us in terms of the fullness of Black people and Black humanity. It makes me think of a poem by Lucille Clifton about celebration. It's called "Won't You Celebrate With Me?" But the key language of the poem lies in a message of not necessarily relying on on the world's definition of you, but to break through and challenge and create a self. And in the full creation of that self, that actually inspires others to follow suit. And then from there, we can build a consciousness and an awareness that does not perpetuate the same mistakes.
Darryl Pinkney, or Ed Pavlich, maybe both, there's a wonderful ambiguity in the whole idea of Afro-pessimism. And I think Claudia Rankine identifies it in Serena. She speaks of an inescapable danger of Blackness in an anti-Black culture that can respond. This is Claudia's line. It can respond to living while Black with death. At the same time, she can see in Serena this unbelievable complication and opening of a broader spectrum of a human celebrity who is Black.
Well, in the United States of America, certainly, there are white people who can imagine Black people who are superior to them and Black people who are inferior to them, but it's very hard for them to imagine Black people who are exactly the same. And so, you know, our social dramas are kind of reflected through larger-than-life figures sometimes. And in this case, Serena Williams is certainly one of them. I still think that things are such that Black people labor under this burden of having to be 100 times better in order to sort of succeed. And I can remember teachers and my parents cautioning me not to let myself be vulnerable to giving them an excuse to sort of kick me out of the game, so to speak, that you had to behave better, that this was the sacrifice you had to make, that you weren't like everyone else. You couldn't be like your white classmates because, you know, the rules were different. And I think, and to some extent, that applies, which is why, you know, Black achievement, Black excellence, is no different now in its emotional value than it was in, say, 1792 or 1775. So I think that part is still there. What's new is the sense of Blackness and Black feeling entering mainstream thought and being a kind of source of inspiration for people of all sort of identifications, looking for a way forward, and a culture to respect and be nourished by. And, you know, Black thinking, Black art, the Black image is certainly now a part of that. And that, I don't think, can be eliminated. And a lot of the conservative protest is, the cry of a dying order, or so I hope.
Ed Pavlich, can you bring it home in 60 seconds?
Well, I don't know if we're getting home, but I want to say that what I see in the brilliance of Serena Williams as a performer, as an athlete, as a person, is how she's been able to, maybe forced to, maybe willing to, maybe both, expose in her performance just the level of work and sweat and failure and success and the whole gamut of what goes on behind the scenes of being twice as good as everybody else to get the same result. You know, it used to be people had to be twice as good and also dissemble the extra work it took to do that. But in Serena, unlike so many other great athletes who made it look effortless, you can see in her performances the highs and lows, the ups, the downs, all this toil and struggle that it's taken. I think she's redeemed our image of struggle.
Interesting. Ed Pavlich, thank you. Thank you, Claudia Rankin, Frank Wilderson, Sarita McFadden, and Daryl Pinkney. Our show this week was produced by All Court All-Stars, producer Rebecca Panovka, and artist Susan Coyne, George Hicks, who umpires our sound. Mary McGrath is our MVP. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.